What is poppin', everyone? Hello and welcome to Popcorn Culture. I am your host, Ben Carlin.
And I am your co-host, Jonathan Carlin.
You're finally leaning into it.
I have been saying we're co-hosts the whole time. You're finally not fighting it.
Oh no.
Aha!
What's happened?
That's right.
I still think you refer to yourself as a co-host, and I'm going to call that a massive win in my book.
We're both co-hosts. Mm-hmm. We're both co-hosts of this here podcast, Ben. As ever, do we want to start with a corny joke? Have you got one for us there?
I think I do, although all of my data in front of me has simultaneously crashed all at once. So, knock, knock.
Who's there?
Control freak.
Control freak.
Okay, now you say control freak who. I feel like that was terrible timing.
That's like interrupting cow.
Moo.
Moo. Yes, excellent, excellent. All right, thank you for that corny joke. This is the first podcast we are recording post-Christmas. It's finally not Christmas.
Oh my gosh, and we've finally seen the rise of Skywalker.
We've seen the rise of Skywalker, and we've seen the finale of The Mandalorian.
Yes, we have, which was actually kind of fascinating. But as a quick heads up to everybody, we will have mild spoilers for The Mandalorian.
Mild.
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 Mild. Like, I feel like we're not really about to, like, you know, give away the wagon or anything like that.
No.
What's the phrase? Give away the windmill.
I think it's throw out the baby with the bathwater.
That is so not what I was thinking of.
Different
I have heard
saying
that phrase.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, phrases are funny, like when people have just, like, not heard a phrase, like, that's super common their entire life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, so my fiance Alice had never heard until like 3 months ago the phrase "give it the old college try."
Really?
Yes. Like, she is a college graduate who has never heard the phrase, give it the old college try.
Wow, that's really funny. Is there anything, like, are there any phrases that you have ever been on the receiving end of this for?
Yes.
Yeah.
There was one, someone to me once said, what has that got to do with the price of tea in China? And I was like, what did you just say? Like, basically someone's like, why is that relevant? Like, that is what it means.
Right, that's the, yeah.
Yeah, but I had never in my entire life heard this totally bizarre phrase that I guess is a thing. Although I do think that many people, I have done a little bit of reading on it now, have like different things. Like, it's not the price of tea always, but like...
Right, it's like the price of butter in China or something.
Right, right. It could be the price of anything.
The price
really.
Of anything.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
What's
as long as it's not really important to you here right now.
Right. What's that
you've
got to do with the price of Legos in China? See, it works. Everyone gets it. The other one that I had, what is the phrase? I made a video about it in year one.
Is this the old wives' tale?
Old wives' tale is one of them, where it's like old wise tale.
Right. Is it an old wise tale or an old wives' tale?
I can't believe that it's old wives' tale. Like, I feel like old wise tale just makes so much more sense. Like, it seems like that is referring to, you know, like that fabled story of the boy who cried wolf or whatever. You know, like it.
Wolf.
I don't know. What did I say?
Woof.
Woof.
Wouldn't that be funny? I know what you meant. If someone, the boy who cried wolf.
The entire story of the boy who cried wolf is actually about a boy who keeps alerting to a disembodied bark.
Yeah, I made a video similar to this in year one about the phrase, for all intents and purposes.
Yes.
And a common mishearing of that phrase is for all intensive purposes.
Yes.
Of which it makes sense because similar to old wise tale, it sounds like all intensive purposes means pretty much the same thing for all intents and purposes.
Exactly. Yeah. Intents and purposes. Like, cause this is something where I definitely my entire life was always saying intensive purposes.
Yeah.
And I would go so far as to make the leap that nobody has ever even realized one, that I was saying the wrong thing, or two, that they also thought the wrong thing was the right thing.
Oh, good. This is what happens is you hear it so fast and it's such a subtle difference that one, you don't want to correct it because you assume either that they just misspoke or that you've been misspeaking the whole time and you don't want to cross either bridge. Like, it's not a big enough deal to like bring up all of a sudden.
Sure.
So you just let it go into the ether and you don't know which one was right.
So you would not correct someone. Almighty for getting one of these wrong.
Oh, no, I would.
You would. Okay.
I personally would.
Oh, strong opinions.
But this is why I believe.
Don't matter.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Strong opinions don't matter. I'm sorry. What was that? I'm sorry. It's old wives' tale, Ben? No.
Oh, my gosh.
This one, I will say, as a kid, for a long time, because it was not a sport that was available to us or talked about very much in school, was volleyball versus volleyball. Like, whether or not it's sort of a B or a V, like, as a small child, I don't know.
Entirely interchangeable.
I don't know what people are saying. Are they saying volleyball or volleyball? Like, it happened so fast, I can't tell.
I could hear that. I could hear that. Although I don't ever remember not thinking that it was volleyball, but now that you say volleyball, I'm fairly certain that I have said volleyball before.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Raise your hands, little colonels, if you have said volleyball or if that was a common... Let us know, hashtag popcorn culture, any phrases you have gotten wrong like this throughout the years.
Yes. Yeah, the only other one that I've heard of is blessing in disguise.
Oh, yes. I know exactly where this is going.
Yes. One of my close friends always thought that it was blessing in the skies.
Right.
And again, it's one of those where I kind of feel like it could make sense.
Right.
Like, a blessing in disguise might be, you know, like your car is in an accident and it already had a problem and the insurance fixed what was otherwise a problem. So like being in a car accident that nobody got hurt in was maybe a blessing in disguise because it ultimately led to your car being more properly fixed.
Right.
Was the example I could come up with immediately off the top of my head.
Yeah, not because your car was recently hit.
My car was recently hit
yeah.
in the street. Yeah, absolutely. I wasn't
sitting still.
Yeah. So somebody was just driving down the street and they were texting and they just ran right into my brand new car. So it doesn't make it any better to have it fixed. But I actually had this want because it was like, I've had it be the case before where I used to drive all the time for work. I had this aquarium company, so
yeah.
I'm constantly like was out in my truck. And the thing is that the more often you are using the vehicle, the greater the likelihood ultimately that you are going to accidentally bump into something with it.
Yes.
Because it's like, you are good at driving 99.99% of the time, but all it takes is that 0.01 time.
Right.
Where you were in a rush or you like pulled into a parking spot and didn't realize that there was like a cement block in front of you or something.
Right.
And then you pull forward and it's like, no.
And you hear that terrible sound.
That happened to me once upon a time. I was fresh out of college. I had bought my new truck. It was my first car that I owned entirely on my own, was making all my own payments and everything. And the girl that I was dating at the time drove a pink car.
Right. I remember
car.
It.
Yeah.
It was bright.
It was, yeah, like literally the license plate was Pepto.
Yeah.
And I'm not joking. Like it actually was.
I remember.
Yeah.
It was one of those cars that you would remember seeing around town.
Right.
And you'd be like, whoa, that's a pink car. Oh, they've even leaned into it.
Right.
Look at the license plate.
They get the joke.
Oh my God, Ben's dating her.
Right. So anyway, I've got my brand new truck and we had a driveway. This was actually when you and I were living together when we started Supercarlin Brothers, the YouTube channel. And I was going to back out one day and I backed out right into this pink car at like 0.5 miles an hour. So it was next to nothing, but it was just barely enough to put a dent in my bumper. And it was not a big deal. It was barely even visible to anybody but me, but it drove me crazy. And I did like everything I could. I bought like a strong magnet thinking I could like pull the dent out of the metal, which was never going to happen.
Right.
Bumpers are like intentionally very solid objects. So it didn't work at all. But all this to say that if that car had gotten run into, then somebody would have had to replace the bumper for me, and it would have been a blessing in disguise.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Exactly. You get it.
Yeah.
Because the blessing would have been raining down on you unexpectedly.
Right.
Just like a blessing in disguise.
Oh, look at that. Look at that.
We made it. We brought it full circle.
I feel like it's almost kind of interesting to me that so many of these like common phrases are so misconstrued. Like I feel like people have almost, it's like LMNOP in the alphabet.
Yeah.
Where people like merge them all together. It's
right.
Like really when people say like intents and purposes or intensive purposes, like they're saying like a word that's really long and has a couple of hyphens in it, but they're just saying one word effectively.
LMNOP.
Like LMNOP, like one letter, you know?
Yeah.
Like what they've done is they've merged all those things into one big cluster and that's it. So it's like, you know, it's blessing in disguise.
This reminds me of a phrase we used to hear from our dad all the time, which was hear what I mean, because oftentimes Being in a house with three teenage sons, you'd get a lot of like smart aleck responses to requests to go do like a chore or something.
Yes.
And be like, take out the trash, and be like, yeah, I took it outside. It's not in the garbage can. And be like, yeah, that's a terrible response.
Right.
Like,
yes.
I did what you said.
Yeah.
Hilarious.
As a general rule, your goal should not be to one up your dad by a technicality.
Yeah. So he like that. I remember this phrase coming up a lot, just hear what I mean. And I feel like I internalize that a lot. Like often when we're shooting videos, I will deliver the information like that I'm saying in the form of a question, and I'm just replacing the words in the question with the words from the script so that it's you're hearing the question, but the words are different.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
You know?
I see what you're saying. Right. Yeah, hear what I mean. No, I mean, it's a good thing in general. I think that it's probably even a decent philosophy, like as you're interacting with others, mm-hmm. is not taking things maybe too literally, but understanding that sometimes like what the actual intention of what the person said was.
Yes. That is a good rule of thumb,
yeah.
For sure. Just what do you think they meant? Oh, I would also just add on to that to give people just the benefit of the doubt
most
of the time.
Yeah.
Like, my assumption whenever I'm talking to someone is not that they are trying to antagonize me.
Oh, sure. Yes, absolutely. Or in general, that's... So I feel like I'm one of these people who is maybe lives in the wonderful land of ignorance, and that like I tend to assume that just all people are good people, and that like in general, people are not out there to like make other people's lives worse.
Right.
And so but I feel like my typical resonance with the way that I imagine how everybody is speaking to the world is under that notion.
Right.
Like, people are not trying to be mean, and maybe they're being mean on accident at times. But otherwise, yes, no, that's typically, I also treat that in the way that I feel like it would be hard to offend me under most circumstances, because I'm usually not assuming that the person is attempting to.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. No one's just coming at you guns blazing. Most of the time. Yeah.
Man.
Yeah. Good thing to carry around with you, I think, is the benefit of the doubt.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
If ever you thought someone offended you, do you think they really meant to?
Right.
Yes.
And why?
Why would they?
And if you're going to peel back those layers, further understanding what may have led that person to reach the point in their life, perspective is such a big thing.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. I am presently reading a book, The 7 Habits of Very Effective People.
Yes.
Which I'm sure you've heard of.
I have heard of it because we have talked about it.
Well, we've talked about it. It's one of the more famous like self-improvement, self-help books.
Sure.
Out there. And
how do you feel about self-help books in general? Is that something like, do you read many of these and attempt to constantly like tweak your life, or is this a first?
Let me tell you something, Ben.
Okay, later.
I have for a long time not read many. I think once upon a time for my job, I was required to, they did like a, you know, corporate book club sort of thing where people jumped on a video call once a month and you had to discuss, you know, a chapter from a leadership book or something.
Sure.
Whatever. And not really, but I think a big part of my problem approaching it or approaching the genre of self-help books is the title of the genre itself.
Sure.
It's because it's called like self-help or self-improvement, which sounds like a good thing, but I think approaching it then also means like it feels like what you're doing to everyone in the bookstore is like, I got problems.
So is your concern the reaction from the people who see that you own the book, or what is your perception of other people who tend to lean on such books?
No, I think my perception, my fear of going over to that side of the bookstore and buying the book is not really the people in the store. That's not really a big deal. But it's just that like, the idea that it like admitting to yourself that you care or something.
Sure.
That like, I don't know. I bring this back to a hair gel conversation you and I have had forever.
Oh, absolutely.
Where like growing up, I had friends or plenty of people like in middle school or high school or whatever would just, you know, style their hair.
Yes.
And I don't know why, but maybe like the first exposure I had to it or the first reaction I heard from it was like, oh God, it's kind of like it was a try hard sort of mood. Like, well, this guy really cares about his appearance, and you can tell because he's putting product in his hair.
Right.
And so for the longest time, I just avoided this at all costs. Like, I don't want to put hair gel in my hair because then people will know I care about what I look like.
Right.
Which I don't want them to know. But of course, I do care what I look like, you know? But you don't, but this, so I think it's sort of the same thing. Like, I want to improve myself, but I don't want people to know I want to improve myself.
It's, and that's, you know what that's, I mean? That's a weird challenge too. Cause I remember the same thing in the early years of our YouTube channel. You can see me like struggling with this exact phenomenon as I'm like taking hair gel. And the rule that I have with myself was that like, I will give myself no more than like 30 seconds to style my hair. And that was it. That was right. It. So it was like, whatever it ended up being at the end of 30 seconds was exactly what it was going to look like. Because anything more than that, if anybody accused me of spending too much time, like 30 seconds that max, that's all I'm doing. It was like, right. It was like, I was giving myself this like rule that like, if I received ridicule that I had already formulated what my counter argument was.
Exactly.
And that's sort of what it came down to. And I think slowly as time went on, I dialed into two big things when it came to my hair. One is that I was perfectly okay with the fact that maybe I cared and that it's not a big deal. And also I get my haircut on a schedule.
There you go.
Like at all times. So I have all of my haircuts planned for 2020 already. There are already appointments made for the entire year.
Yeah, that's so smart. That's so smart. I always forget to schedule mine, and then the place we get our haircut is often so booked that I'll be like, oh yeah, I'll just schedule it. And then it'll end up being another 2 weeks or something before I can actually get in. And I'm like, oh no, now it's going to get real bad.
Real bad.
Yeah. What's funny to me about your story about only allowing yourself 30 seconds to style your hair is that you came up with the defense, but then you also lived by the defense as well.
Yes.
You know, because you could so easily
lie.
Like, no, because no one's going to know. Like, yeah, I do, but I literally set a timer for 30 seconds and I don't care that much. You can spend 5 minutes. No one knows. No one's in the bathroom with you.
I know, but you know? I don't know that I could, back when I'm already self-conscious about something in the manner that I was. I don't think that I could back it with a lie. Like, I think I would have needed the truth in order to feel comfortable enough with this situation. Like I was already self-conscious, so I feel like I already would have felt like I was under the microscope,
mm-hmm.
and surely somebody was going to see straight through my clever foil.
This is a weird thing. I have felt a similar pull on this with insoles in shoes.
Okay.
Like which sounds so weird, but like, I don't know if there's like a connotation to having an insole in your shoe or something, or like, oh, you want, maybe it's just for comfort or something, or maybe you went and got the super feet fitting or something at the running store. And I don't know why I feel like it's a weird thing, but it's one of those things that like, no one's gonna know. Like I don't know why I would feel self-conscious about having insoles in my shoes, which I don't, but.
You feel like there's an obligation to like let people know. It's like, wow, I love those shoes. It's like, thanks, I have insoles.
Exactly. You're just like, why do you feel guilty about it? When literally no one could possibly know that you do this thing. Like, it baffles me whenever I come across one of these situations. Going back to the book itself, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, there's like a section I'm on right now where they talk about
getting insoles.
Exactly. They're like, 7 habits, always insoles in your shoes.
always.
That's one of the habits it's of essential. Successful people.
By the way, this episode is brought to you by Dr. Scholes. No, I'm just kidding. It's not.
It's foot levelers. Also not. One of the chapters, it's surprisingly, none of the habits are like things you can physically do. They're often more like mindsets you should try and adopt.
Sure.
Yeah. Anyway, one of them is that like divulging your motivation to other people is often a significant way to build trust with that person. And like, I remember he was reading, because I'm listening to it on audiobook, and as those words hit me, I was like, I am so bad at this. Like, that's one of those things that is, like, almost always on my mind, that, like, I never want people to know what is motivating me or why I'm doing stuff or anything. And would it make such a difference to just tell people what I want, you know, like instead of having to work my way around it? I don't even know if I'm going to have a good example for you, but I feel like this is constantly a problem for me where I like do not want to reveal my motivation for things because I think my issue is that I don't think whenever I feel like I want something, I feel like I probably shouldn't want that.
Not okay to like, have wanted it. It's not okay to feel guilty about it.
That's welcome to my life. I feel guilty.
Just all the time. Yes. A constant state of being. No, I actually completely understand that because I think that I've frequently felt the same way. Like the last thing in the world I've ever wanted to divulge to anybody is the things that actually make me happy.
Right.
Because in letting people know that, it was almost like they could like then somehow in some perverse world use it against me.
Right. Right.
The other thing for me is that if I'm ever experiencing like pure joy, I feel like I am feeling guilty because I have probably like pushed people to do something longer than they already wanted to do it.
Right.
Like, so I remember when I was in high school, this thing like I got so excited about doing once upon a time, I went out and I bought these huge tarps. They were like these massive, like, you know, just tarps. Yeah. And we would put them in the backyard.
What were they?
They were tarps.
Tarps.
Tarps. Like, you know, a tarp.
For like camping.
For like camping.
Yeah.
Or for covering the backyard in.
Yeah. And for water sliding.
For water sliding. Yeah. Yeah. So we had this backyard where you had like our basement like had these doors that would open out. And there was like this concrete pad. And the concrete pad went to like this small slope that like went across our backyard. So what I would do is I would go and I would stake it all in. And then I would use like dish soap and I would like cover the whole thing. And I would have like a hose out there. And it would be like this really, really awesome slip and slide.
Yeah.
And it was this thing that I absolutely loved doing. And aside from the guilt that I definitely felt like from dad, who was inevitably going to be furious at me for killing the backyard, both through soap and through covering, you know, like...
Yeah, blocking the grass from the sun.
300 square feet of grass, which probably my guilt should have come from not cleaning up, which is ultimately what did happen, but that's right. Not where my guilt came from. My guilt came while I was out there. Like, I would, like, run up to the top, slide down, get up, and sprint back to the top as fast as I could, and then slide down, and then sprint back up as fast as I could, and I would just do this, and I was having so much fun.
Do you mean just by yourself in the
backyard?
No.
Like with, okay. with 20 people there, like tons of people, everyone having a good time, like all fun. And I would be like, am I doing this too much? Like probably people probably want to go inside, don't they? Like right. They've probably had enough of me slipping and sliding, but like, I really want to keep doing it.
Right.
And like, I would immediately be like, I should stop now. I've had enough fun for one day. Like yeah. I've enjoyed myself. Let it go, Ben. Let it go.
People aren't going to enjoy this for so long. You had like maybe 30 seconds of this. Okay, that was enough.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
No, I totally know what you mean. This is how I feel. This is how I knew the trajectory of Pokemon Go was going to go when that came out.
Oh, yes.
Once upon a time. Because the first few weeks, it was like pandemonium. Everyone was everywhere playing it. You couldn't go anywhere without seeing people like failing to log into the game or whatever.
Right. No, absolutely. It was the first time you really saw, like, I mean, it was like trending on Twitter the whole time. Like
yeah.
Anywhere you were out driving, like near parks and stuff, there were just like groups of people all like walking around like a little huddle.
Yeah.
Like it was a thing.
It was a thing. And it was a thing that almost from the beginning, I had trouble like enjoying because I was having so much fun with it. And I intrinsically knew that my enthusiasm for this game would carry way past all my friends who were suddenly into it for a month.
Right.
And it was just like, I'm not going to be able to continue to ask you guys to go do this with me after a certain amount of time. And I will say that it lasted longer than expected, but sure enough, it's like, it will always fizzle eventually. And like, if you know your enthusiasm, it's like, if you feel too enthusiastic about something, which is a phrase I don't like at all, that fear that you're bothering people with your enthusiasm, it can like, yeah, like really eat away at you.
No, it absolutely can. Yeah, I think this is like, this is like if we go out to dinner with the family and I'm having like a particularly like in-depth conversation with one family member, I'm like, oh, man, everybody else is probably annoyed that like we're not, you know, paying enough attention to the rest of the conversation or something like
right.
that. You know, and you're like, oh, crap. But so what do we do? What would the self-help book tell us to do?
Well, I don't know. I think for one, it would tell you to probably admit what your motivation is up front. You know, if you want to... If you're trying to like sneakily suggest people back to the house and be like, hey, what do you know? The slip and slide is already set up. Huh. What do you know?
How about
should
that?
You guys brought swim trunks, right?
Should we do it? Should we go outside?
Should we go outside? Yeah.
I'm pretty sure mom has a fresh thing of Dawn.
Yeah.
Dawn dish soap.
Like rather than trying to like sway the crowd's opinion to get to where you want, just be like, I want to go do this.
I want to go slip and slide right now.
I
want
to go slip and slide.
And you should
right
too.
Now. Yeah. I guess that is probably what it would say. It's been a very interesting read.
Yeah.
For sure. So it turned me on to the idea of self-help books, but I still don't like the phrase self-help book. Like, I don't know what is a better phrase.
I don't know, but like... It is true in that I feel like I tend to associate and very unfairly, like this is not even like my own opinions, but like almost what I assume public opinion of self-help books is like sort of in that same category of people who get like really into like multi-level marketing schemes.
Oh.
Like those are the types of things where I feel like people get so sold on this idea of like, you are going to own your own business. You are an entrepreneur. entrepreneur. Like
multi-level marketing.
I know. So then like all of a sudden you've got this like sticker on the back of your car that says, you know, like Sensi brought to you by Ben Carlin, which this is not a true story. I've never been, you know,
right.
I've never fallen into one of those holes before. But there's a certain perception about it.
Yeah.
Possibly throwing in there people who are like really big on like astrological signs, you know, it's like, oh that person's such a Scorpio.
Yes, and I'll tweet Ben about that.
Which by the way, I am a Scorpio. Classic, I know, right?
Huh. A Scorpio thing to say.
I know. Maybe. Is that a thing? I don't know. But yeah, no, I feel like that's self-help books, multi-level marketing schemes, and horoscopes.
Yeah.
Astrology.
I think there are certainly some scenarios where you get more into reading like a self-help books than you are into improving yourself.
Sure.
You know, like, what I mean?
Maybe there's a bit of an endorphin high over the very nature of actively doing something that is making you feel like you are bettering yourself,
right?
Even if you are never actually following. Right.
Like I'm reading the books, that's doing it. It's like with the but you have to do what the books say,
right?
You know, that's
right.
That's sort of the thing. And there, this is why I feel like it is probably one of the more effective or more famous books, is that it does cover that kind of mentality even within it.
Okay.
Where, like, for example, they talk about, they bring it back to like your center or whatever, which is like the thing that drives most of your decisions. And one of the examples they give is occasionally people will be like really church centered or whatever, which sounds like a great thing to motivate all of your decisions. And they'll be really active and they'll go to lots of activities and they'll do lots of stuff at the church, but they won't be like practicing the stuff the church is teaching outside of it. Like, they're really involved in being at the physical location, but they're like, they're not really living their gospel per se.
Yeah. Like, and I don't even know that it's like the wrong reasons, because I don't know if there's like a wrong reason to get like caught up in community under like any basis of the idea. And I want to tell a story about our younger brother, Tyler, here. And hopefully he wouldn't hear this, because Tyler is a huge community person.
Yeah.
Like, forever, he's been somebody who I think has been drawn to the idea of like being a part of the bigger thing.
Yeah.
And I think like throughout his life, one of the ones in particular was like marching band in high school.
Yeah.
And the marching band at our school, it was this thing where like, if you joined it, you were like part of like this strange kind of in crowd. Like, I think almost everybody in the marching band would like not consider themselves, you know, like mean girls, quote unquote, popular at our school. But the thing was, is that there was more of them than there was anyone else.
Right.
And they all got along super well with each other. So
right.
Like, you know, you're in the marching band, you're friends with 100 people.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas like me on like, you know, my cross country team or whatever, there were 20 of us. So
right.
Like, even if I was super tight knit with my whole team, you have way more friends than I do by a mile.
Right.
But so I think Tyler really, really, really loved being a part of that whole environment and got super into that whole environment. But I never got the sense that he was obsessed with like playing the trumpet as much.
Mm.
Did you ever, I don't know if maybe that's a fair assessment or maybe not, or maybe I just went to college and missed his glory years of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I would have been in college before you. You would have been at home with Tyler more during high school than me. I mean, I think he probably enjoyed the trumpet more than you and I enjoyed playing whatever instruments we played.
Well, that's there's no doubt about that. Yeah,
yeah.
He was definitely better at the thing than we were at our respective instruments.
Yeah.
I will tell you, I joined the band in sixth grade so that I could go to New York in eighth grade.
That was like a big thing.
That was like my big commitment. Yeah. So you knew about the famous like band trip that you got to go on.
Yeah.
And that was like my entire driving force.
Yeah. It's weird the way I got introduced into band, because the school in sixth grade made you choose an elective, but your elective could only be one of three things, really. It was learn an instrument in the band, or be in the choir, or art. And I, you know, learn an instrument. That seems cool.
Right.
You know, I wasn't particularly artistic, or didn't consider myself so anyway, and I have never thought of myself as being good at singing, so it was really not really that many choices, and it was just like, you're doing it out of obligation more than, like, desire to be musical.
Right,
which,
right. Like, yeah. You had to, like, fill a class.
Yeah, basically. Sure. Basically. That was my relationship with the trumpet, which I was not super good at.
That's okay. That's
yeah,
okay.
Totally. Continuing the idea of inclusion and stuff, though, I see you have some notes on our lovely document here about the peripheral materials associated with various fandoms.
Okay, yeah,
and
absolutely.
How, yeah, that can. So, for example, Star Wars is a great example of this because you have the main movies, which are super pop culture. Most people are pretty aware of the general idea of Star Wars and lightsabers and Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker and stuff. But then there's the comics and the books and the video games, and how much of that, like, how much does not consuming that affect your relationship with people who do in terms of the fandom?
Right. So I think it's really like a complicated way to look at it because, and I think, you know, Star Wars is a great example because they do have so much peripherals, but like, I know people who would consider themselves Harry Potter fans and it's like, yeah, I love those movies. And like, to me, I'm like, the movies, like you must be like, but you mean the books, right? You mean the books. But then I feel like we go so far with it that, you know, like not only, you know, have we read the books over and over and over again, of course, seeing the movies start to finish over and over and over again, but we read like all of the articles, we read the interviews, we read, you know, the Wizarding World, J.K. Rowling writing that gives you like to the nth degree on just anything that ever went unexplained so that you have like the complete backstory to everything all the time and always.
Right.
Like how important does that stuff ultimately become? Should it play a role? Like for Star Wars fans, for example, I would be willing to bet that there are plenty of Star Wars fans who they're only interaction with it is they have seen all 11 movies, you know, 9 episodes and 2 Star Wars stories.
Or some combination
yeah. of that. Yeah. And so it gets interesting, I think, especially because of how that information can ultimately affect what you see on the big screen.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, like for the main movies, for the main episodes, every decision is, you know, contested, of course, because of Star Wars. But it's also something where there's an enormous amount of pressure on what they ultimately decide to consider canon.
Right.
Like, what counts in the biggest, most obvious way? And so those decisions have to be taken with a lot of care, and it needs to be really cautious. But then, if you have offshoots of all these characters who you didn't really see that much on screen, where they want to give us more of a backstory, you know, to Boba Fett or you know, that one stormtrooper or whoever, mm-hmm. you know, it's like they'll have someone write an entire book that gives their whole origin story, who they are, how they grew up, where they're from. And I don't know how this works. I'm not deep enough into the world of, you know, the behind the scenes of writing such an enormous story that is covered by so many different people. But to me, it almost feels like canon information can get added to the story in such a low bar kind of setting where most fans probably didn't read the novelization of,
right,
you know, or the backstory to,
mm-hmm.
you know, insert character here. And so all of a sudden it's like how much value it is technically canon by the rules that we all agree to, but what happens if all of a sudden there's a better story that makes so much more sense, but it's been defeated because there is a backstory to that character? Can I give you my example? Because I'm trying not to give away the lighthouse over here.
give away the lighthouse.
Throw out
the lighthouse with the bathwater.
That's the one.
Exactly.
Okay, so here's where I'm going to give the warning.
Give me your example.
Okay, so I'm going to give my example. So The Mandalorian has been out for a little while now, and it's been a truly interesting story, which, by the way, small spoilers about to come for The Mandalorian. But it's been an interesting story because in a lot of ways it has been a show about nothing, in the same way that, you know, like Seinfeld, for example, like one of the biggest comedies of all time,
right.
sitcoms of all time, that's sort of like how it was always described. It's a show about nothing.
Yeah. Self-described.
Yeah. So The Mandalorian, each episode, it's sort of like a complete one-off so far where you were like, you get into it and it's like, oh, hey, look, we're on a new planet and he met a new guy and that guy helped him do a thing. Oh, how cool was that? See you later. And
right.
it's like they were all like these self-contained little stories where ultimately at the end of the season, it came full circle.
It does come full circle.
Right.
Eventually.
And you see everybody sort of like come back into the fold eventually. But for the most part, like there's not these insane moments in every story where you need to go through and pick apart each episode and like really dissect like, oh, what did he mean like by that? And what does that probably mean? And what are they setting us up for? Like it's a slow moving story that is nothing but entertaining.
Right. Like you've got little baby Yoda.
Right.
And you know he's important. You know, people are hunting him, and that's very slowly sort of pushing on the plot, but it's not the main focus of every episode.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I guess my thinking here, my theory that I was slowly coming to as I'm watching the final episodes is in The Mandalorian, we have this one character sort of in the sewers, the Mandalorian covert, where they have all the other Mandalorian.
Just say it fast. People. No one will know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
The covert. Mandalorian covert.
The covert.
Culvert.
I hope we maybe have done it too many times now and people are going to know what we're saying.
The covert culvert.
Exactly. So the Mandalorian covert culvert, you have this armorer and we first meet her, I think, in episode 3 when he's having his shoulder made.
Yeah. I think that's even episode 1.
Oh, it is episode 1. Yeah. It is episode 1. Okay, so we meet her in episode 1, and he's gotten like the little ingot of the Beskar metal, which he brings downstairs, and she melts it down, and they turn it into the arm guard for him. And you, I guess even at first, you don't realize that it's a woman that is this armorer.
Mm-hmm.
But like as it goes on, you know, she speaks, and you're like, oh, wow, that's kind of crazy. But as the episodes have gone on, we've gotten to know her just like a little bit more, and in the final episode, you do get to see her like in combat mode a little bit.
Right.
So my theory, based on almost no information, just like while I'm sitting there watching it, is what if that is Captain Phasma?
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden I'm like, oh, I kind of like this. I kind of like it because, mm-hmm. you know, it's like she's this character that does come from this like crazy combat world. And, you know, she's got like the particular chrome armor.
Right. It's very different.
It's very distinctive. It's very strong.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, if you're like, whoa, did Phasma make her own armor?
Oh, yeah, it sounds really cool.
It sounds so cool.
Yeah.
It sounds so cool and so fitting. And like, even like when you see her go to battle, like with all of her wrenches and stuff, it's like, she just comes across to me as like this like mega master of her craft. You sort of understand, like, I mean, she's fighting with like tongs and a hammer, you know,
right.
like quite literally the tools of her trade.
Yeah.
Not weapons, not blasters, not anything like that.
Right.
So I'm like, oh my gosh, like how cool would it be if that's what it ends up being? But it just so happens to be the case that there's a novelization of Phasma's origin.
Right.
You kind of like dive into it and you find out she's got this brother and, you know, with her relationship with her brother, there's sort of like a, he was injured as a child, so he can't really like go into battle, but she's like the brawn and he's the brains of the situation.
Right.
And, you know, he's like this big time pacifist, but somewhere along the way he dies and then you're like, oh, maybe that's where it comes from. Like maybe she's like a good guy because she's got this like force coming from her brother and it's so cool. And I don't know. Like, so I'm like putting together this whole story in my head.
Right.
But then as I keep reading more about the novelization of Phasma, it's like, nope. It's not what it is. This armorer woman is not Phasma, basically because the novelization prevents it from being so.
Right.
Like it wouldn't work.
Yeah.
And that disappoints me.
That disappoints you because it's tricky with Star Wars. And I think one of the reasons it's so difficult for us on the channel to discuss Star Wars is because of the vastness of the universe. And if you want to like have a theory about something, we've had this problem before where everything can line up, but it just turns out a thing about a character in a novel or in a single panel of a comic totally undoes this. And you're like, well, it's there. Okay.
Right.
And that can be frustrating. And I remember before Disney acquired Star Wars, this was sort of how I had started to feel about Star Wars. Like, as a kid, I felt like I knew everything. We watched the movies all the time. We had all the action figures. We had all the games and stuff. And then you'd go to look up, you know, the information about Chewbacca or something. And, you know, Chewbacca's pretty important to the plot. And he has some stuff. He does some things. But certainly not enough to make his Wikipedia page 70 pages long, which somehow it is.
Sure.
You're like, God, I thought I knew Chewbacca.
And oh, but like,
turns
but you,
out.
But you don't.
It just turns out, my goodness, see, there's been so, wow, it keeps going. God, geez, this is a long entry. And it's so difficult to know every little thing about Star Wars. And it's so difficult to then to theorize about it because if you don't know everything, then you might just already be wrong. You might be dead in the water before you even started. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, so that becomes the question to me, though, is I think with Star Wars, all of a sudden they're going to be, you know, like as they continue to expand the universe, as they continue to make more content that has more eyes on it, which I would argue The Mandalorian does, you know, with the release of Disney Plus, and it's definitely like their flagship like title that came with the release of the service.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden you have an offshoot that maybe not like all Star Wars fans watch, but I would be willing to bet, you know, if you're going to consider yourself a Star Wars fan, if you've watched all the episodes, that's, you know, we'll call that, you know, 99% of Star Wars fans or whatever, the number of people who read the Phasma book, I bet is like 2%.
Oh, yeah.
It's a very, very, very small select crowd of people who are like the deep divers that want everything and they can't get enough, and that's what they do. I would be willing to bet that like 70% in that formula have watched The Mandalorian. Like, enough eyes will have hit it because it's been so talked about, because it's so good, you know, that ultimately more people will consume it, which to me then makes me wonder, like, where does it fall in this hierarchy of, would we ever be willing to, like, put an X mark over something in order to allow a better story to happen?
I don't think so.
Really? So yeah. That's what I'm saying. I feel like the bar to enter into the world of canon in the novelization is lower to me than it is anywhere else, but now we all have to abide by that bottleneck.
Well, have you ever read any of the Star Wars novels?
I have read bits of some of them.
Okay, so I think what you'll find if you read them is that they are not often, they really will not be that impactful to anything other than developing the character itself.
Sure.
And, you know, yeah, it is probably weird if you, you know, saw Captain Phasma in the movies. She does almost nothing except lower the shields at Starkiller Base and then lose a fight to Finn. And you're like, okay, yeah, I bet your entry into the encyclopedia is about two paragraphs long. And then all of a sudden, it scrolls forever. And you're like, how did I miss all this stuff?
Right.
But the thing is, like, when, I don't know, I've read a bunch of the Star Wars novels and I've never really felt like, oh, okay. It's never affected the way I watch the movies or anything. You know, like, because often the movies are already made, so it's not like the characters, all of a sudden, motivations are seen, like, through a new lens or something.
Well, and I agree. Like, and I think the big thing is that they all know, anybody who's in part in producing the movies is never going to have made it a requirement for you to read all the peripheral material in order to understand what's happening on screen.
That is always true. So that's the other thing about, yeah, like, peripheral material, like novels and comic books and stuff, is if it's going into the movie, the big thing, that, because that's always the highest thing is the movies,
right?
Well, Star Wars anyway. Then, like, they are never going to require you to see anything, to have read or invested in anything other than the movies to know what's going on.
Right. And, but so I feel like this is, it's almost like a trend that has to be broken. So it's like, your argument is almost like the novelizations are never going to tamper with anything important enough. And I'm almost like, well, I'm never going to read the novelizations until they make them important enough to tamper with something. Does that make sense? Well, like,
I think The Mandalorian has done a pretty good job of bridging. It's interesting because The Mandalorian is the first live action show.
Yes.
And until now, all we've had is animated shows. And for whatever reason, Star Wars has kept certain characters and objects and ideas seemingly, like, relocated to the TV shows. Like, this all happened, it counts, but you don't need to know. Like, the famous character is Anakin's Padawan, Ahsoka.
Yes.
Like, her impact on the galaxy, massive. Would you even know about her if all you've seen was the movies? Absolutely not. Do you need to? No, doesn't matter. But The Mandalorian has, since it's live action, they have, like, started to bridge some of the animated stuff into the real world of Star Wars.
Right.
And it'll be interesting to see if then the things introduced in The Mandalorian make it into a movie. Because it's easy to say, well, that show was kind of, it's like animated, it's made for kids. We can't expect every adult to have seen it or know. But none of that stuff has ever migrated into the movies.
Right.
But they have started migrating stuff from those shows into The Mandalorian.
They have, yeah. Yes. And we don't have to go into specifics. But the finale, absolutely,
yeah,
is like there's a key example, yeah, of that.
For sure there is.
Which we will probably talk about eventually. So if you haven't watched The Mandalorian, I'm going to warn you that eventually that will come up.
I feel like I also just want to throw in, like, I don't want anyone listening to be under the impression that, like, having not seen everything or read everything means you're not some sort of true fan of something.
Oh, no, of course not. Yeah, you know? Yeah. No, there's nothing more frustrating to me that, like, yeah, I feel like for Super Carlin Brothers, for example, like, everything has always been, like, Disney, Pixar, Star Wars, Harry Potter, and Marvel. And we've never really had a mission statement for the channel. Like,
right.
We've never really had, like, a central goal or idea or anything that we were trying to do. But the phrase that I feel like you and I always kept coming back to was sort of this sentiment of celebrate your fandom.
Yeah, which is now in the intro.
It's now in the intro. And I think that is a huge thing, because the whole idea of anything that we ever, like, are attempting to make is to allow for a place for people to come together and enjoy the thing that we all enjoy.
Right.
And I think there's nothing that frustrates me more than when I feel left out of something because someone has suggested the idea that, like, oh, well, it sounds like you're not, like, into it enough to be a part of this conversation.
Right.
So I don't think that in any way, shape, or form. What we're trying to suggest is that the only way to be a true Star Wars fan is to
read everything.
To be part of the 2%. Like, what I would say is that Star Wars fans, are that, like, 100%. And that is, like, anybody who enjoys Star Wars in any capacity.
Mm.
I think my assertion is that my bet is that most people who would classify themselves as a Star Wars fan have probably seen the main episodes.
Right.
You know, like, that
you probably haven't dove too much deeper than that.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And that's, I'm right there with you. Like, I have seen, like, I haven't watched Rebels, I haven't watched Clone Wars, I haven't watched or read all of the novelizations.
Yeah.
I have played Star Wars Battlefront 2.
There you go. And read, like, 12 Darth Vader comics.
Yeah.
Yeah, we started collecting those, and then we fizzled out. But now, there's, like, only 25. We could do it. We can collect them all.
We could do it. But what I really want to do is collect all the covers. That's collecting things. I don't know why. This is just, like, I feel like it was instilled in me also because of Star Wars as a child.
That's true.
Where, as a kid, we were, like, we had these totes with the action figures, and we just had, like, one of everything. And we knew, like, all the character names, and, like, when we went to, like, the store, it was always, like, we knew, like, what the newly released action figure was. It was like, oh, we've never seen that one before. That must be a new release.
Yeah.
So we were pretty fanatical about it.
Yes, we were.
And that's, like, one of those things that, yeah, now to this day, when the Darth Vader comics released, I was like, okay, Darth Vader, big deal. Love hearing more about what Darth Vader was like early on.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's almost Darth Vader's origin story opposed to, like, Anakin Skywalker's, which is what the prequels were, which makes it interesting in and of itself. But what I really cared about was getting every alternate cover of every comic.
Yeah.
That is what I wanted. That's what I was in it for.
We'll have to keep hunting them down. We've got a bunch. Because I think the first issue had, like, 10 or 12, and then after that it was just, like, 2 per comic.
Yeah, so it got easier.
Yeah, it got easier after the first one. The first one, there was a lot of really hard ones.
Yes.
We've got a lot of them. I would say I, like, at one point made it my goal to try and consume all of the Star Wars. Like, I'm gonna...
How'd,
like,
that go?
Well, it's certainly not done, I'll tell you that. Like, the thing is, even knowing everything to consume is hard.
It is.
Like, if you're just trying to find, okay, I want to read all the novels. Finding just a comprehensive list of all the novels is hard. Of, like, here's, you want them all? Here they are in order. Read, these are the ones you need to read. It's like 30.
Sure, sure.
At this point, there's a bunch.
So what used to be a huge, huge, huge amount of information got cut down to a smaller amount of information when Disney bought Star Wars.
Yeah.
But since then, it's continued to grow into another huge amount of information.
It has, it has. So I think I've probably read, probably, I don't know, 10 of them or something. And I have a few that I own that I have not read. But I have, like, a bookmark tab on my computer that is, here's all of the Star Wars novels. And even that, you have to sort through because there's, like, the junior novelization. And then there's the novelization of the movie. And I'm like, I don't want to read that again.
Sure.
Like, that to me doesn't count. And it's like, then there's, you have to, like, really siphon it down to, these are the main regular novels written for adults that aren't adaptations of other things, books about Star Wars. And it's just like, that's a hard list to get.
It is. Somebody what really needs to just go through and have a concise, easy way to, like a checklist.
Yes. Oh my gosh. So StarWarsChecklist.com. These are the movies you need to watch. That's a pretty short list, and I know all those. Here's all the shows you need to watch. There's only like 4. Then here's all the books. Here's all the comics. Play these video games.
That's caught up.
I want. And then you're caught up. It'll take you years. And even just track, it'll take you so much money, too. Oh, man. We had some people to give a little feedback when we were talking about, like, the spoiler culture.
Yes.
Saying, like, oh, if you haven't seen something in 3 weeks, then you're not, like, a diehard fan.
Uh-huh.
And, like, some of the feedback was, like, what if I can't get to the movies? What if I don't have, like, the money to see it? And I would say, certainly we were not talking, like, if your circumstances are out of your control, I don't think that really... That doesn't really apply to you.
Oh yeah.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Right. Yeah. No, I think that's one of those things where there are absolutely 100% all the time and always exceptions to that particular scenario. I think the answer to that question when we say 3 weeks is maybe more like our baseline as to, like, when, as people who make content about these specific things for a living, what my guideline is personally before my guilt is eased enough to where I'm like, someone's about to find something out probably through a thumbnail and I really, really, really don't want to have spoiled something for someone. somebody, especially if it's something awesome.
Right.
But at some point in time, we do have to do our job.
Right.
and people are asking the question, and surely someone else will answer it if we don't.
That's the thing. I will always check to be like, how spoilery are we making the title of the thumbnail right now? And I would just like put like search YouTube to see if other people have already started to spoil it. And it's just like, it is out there. The answer is yes. People have.
But that's the thing though. So in case you're ever wondering like what it's like being on the inside, like on this side of pressing upload on that particular episode or video or picture or whatever, it is a big deal. It's something that we have conversations about all the time. And we're like, you know, I think we have literally lessened our thumbnails before, reducing the clickability of that particular video simply in the name of attempting to preserve the spoiler.
Ooh, yes. Actually, the video we did last week, I showed you one thumbnail and you were like, I don't know if that's the most interesting thing we talked about in this video. What if we did this? And I made another thumbnail and you came back and you're like, this is 1,000 times better. Is it too spoilery? And I was like, yes. So I've got like a reminder on my phone to change the thumbnail at some point. And I don't really even think people would notice, but if you do, let me know.
There you go. What episode was it?
Yeah, you'll have to just see how good are you at keeping track of where we are.
Right.
Especially since this podcast doesn't really come out the day it was recorded or anything.
Right, yeah, exactly. So last week, in terms of when we're recording this, is different relative to when you're hearing it.
Exactly.
Yes. Okay, so, but going from there then, like talking about peripheral content, like this is a lot of what we do, is like we're always trying to go down the rabbit hole and find the information that maybe the person who watches the big screen.
Yeah.
And we do it with everything, you know, Disney, Pixar, Star Wars, Harry Potter, Marvel, the whole sweep of it. How much stock, if any, do you put into on-the-fly responses about, like, major information by either, like, the writer or director or the actor of a given character?
Oh,
because
boy.
I would be willing to bet that, like, when decisions are being made in the storyboard room, that there are papers everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you ever wanted to, or a deleted scene, for that matter. Like, if you wanted to go to a deleted scene.
Our deleted
and be like,
scenes canon.
If they help us.
That's pretty much my answer. Anyway, but
I know we're rather flexible with whether or not a deleted scene helps or hurts the scenario. Usually it depends on whether or not I think our theory is actively making the story better, and if it is, then I will count it to whatever extent I need to.
Right. Yeah. Is this deleted scene hurt our theory? No, it doesn't count. It's a deleted scene. Does it help? Oh, yeah, look at this. They almost did it.
Right.
Come on, guys. Jeez.
Right.
No, I think one deleted scene in particular that came up recently was when Endgame came out. People were like, what happened to Gamora? After the snap, because you don't see her again in the movie. She's the only one not at the funeral. And there's a deleted scene where post-snap, you can see her on the battlefield, sort of like mourning or, you know, just recovering after the battle. People are like, oh, no, she didn't get snapped away because you can see her in the deleted scene, so they must not have wanted to. And it's like, that's a really interesting one to me, because whether or not she got snapped away is a really interesting discussion point. And the fact that there was a scene that they deleted, in some ways you can be like, you can argue it either way. You can say either, look, oh, they obviously didn't intend for her to be snapped because they put her on the battlefield and they just didn't put the scene in. But then you could say, oh, maybe they took the scene out because they intended for her to be snapped. And they're like, well, now we can't include the scene.
I know.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. So maybe what we can title it is like just literally the Gamora argument.
Oh,
where
yeah.
It's like, which side of the argument do you fall on?
The Gamora paradox.
Yes. Mm. So it's like, it's so much more fun if she snapped away.
Right.
You know, or if, yeah, because there's no other way for her to leave.
Yeah.
Everything has just been destroyed.
Yeah.
And all of Thanos' forces just got snapped away. So,
right.
Like, there's no, like, just jogging away from this scene, finding another plane, flying it into space, and showing up some other time way in the future.
Right, right.
Knowing whether
or not she was snapped makes the next Guardians movie so much more interesting.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah.
And so, that would be curious, and that's something that I definitely would like to see use hashtag popcorn culture.
Ooh, this feels like a video. The Gamora paradox.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
This is how it happens, by the way. If
right
you're like, how do they come up with these ideas? Usually a conversation exactly like this one, and we're like, hey, that's interesting.
Should we do that? Should we put it on the board?
Yeah, yeah.
What are all of our arguments here?
There you go.
Yeah.
But yeah, so then the other end of it altogether is, so I think I am hesitant sometimes, like when a character or someone. Like, I think Finn, John Boyega tweeted something about, like, what Finn's character was going to tell Rey.
Right.
The other day. And it's almost like, as the actor of Finn, you want to give him a little bit of stock, but also the actor has absolutely zero say on the story.
I think that comes down to a case-by-case basis.
Yes.
Because I can believe that John Boyega literally knows what Finn was going to say because they cut it out of the movie, and there was a script with his lines about it, which again is the same thing. If they cut it out, does it count?
Exactly. Know. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the Gamora paradox.
It's the Gamora paradox. Again, it's exactly that.
It's acting up everywhere.
It's everywhere. But I can give him some credit. To, like, I would think that, I would take that more seriously. Of course, J.J. Abrams has said specifically what Finn was going to say. So, and I would say, I do take him seriously there. Specifically because it's an unfairly unanswered question.
Sure.
Which is really annoying. And because he was the director. So it's like his story.
Sure.
Yeah.
Director and writer.
So I feel like that gives some credence. But then it's like, it's not in the movie.
I know.
There is still that. So yeah. Boy. I know. This is like a thing for sure that Harry Potter fans have had to deal with forever. Because the story's creator was frequently on Twitter dropping things. And you'd be like, oh, that changes everything. But it's not in a book.
It's so weird, I think, especially with the J.K. Rowling case.
Mm-hmm.
Because she, in a lot of ways, I feel like has almost... Like we like to think that J.K. Rowling is this person who, like, walks around with this massive bank of information in her head about everything all the time and always.
Mm-hmm.
And like, we're probably not giving enough credit to the person that was writing the stories, that had notes all around her, that was like very carefully and meticulously like checking and rechecking to make sure that like all the things like lined up perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
Compared to this person who has now gone on to just do like other things with her life, and like it or not, even for herself, the thing that she is forever going to be most known for is Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm.
And so one way or another, that's where she's going to get the most questions. One way or another, that's probably where the majority of like her future work is going to spawn from in mm-hmm. terms of like future movies and stories and, you know, whatever the case may be. But it's tricky. It really is, because I feel like she can make mistakes with characters that we, the audience, are so tuned into that we're aware of it. Like,
yeah,
it's almost like you're no longer the authority on it unless you're going to go and sit back in that room with all the pieces of red yarn connecting all the dots.
Right.
And like all the backstory. The difference I will grant her the credit on is I think the writings by J.K. Rowling on what was formerly Pottermore, now Wizarding World.
Right.
Where those tend to be pretty airtight.
They were. I think that was the point. Like, this is an expansion of the story.
Right.
And they were like, I think what I liked about those is that they were like small and digestible. And yeah, they didn't really often conflict with the story, like provided you with the kind of background info and stuff. And you could be like, yeah, I see why this doesn't really affect much.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So it's interesting. It's weird. It's hard. I do think that we tend to forget that people are people sometimes when it comes to things like this. Like, you hold them in this magnitude that is like, I don't know. Like, I think for me so often, like, I think of the world of Harry Potter, like, just existing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, it's not like stuff that's being made up. It's not it's all real. Like, it's there. Like,
it's there. Like, the world is there. Yeah.
Like, everything has to make sense because the world makes sense. Like,
yeah.
Like, you can ultimately unravel anything and get to the part of it that you want.
Yeah. I think that's why so many people like Harry Potter, because they feel like it really is there. And it's all this sort of like shared collective conscience about what it's like.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And everyone likes to be a part of that together.
And nobody wants it to be ruined.
Nobody wants it to be ruined. That's why I think people get so like gun shy when things are challenged on the Harry Potter front, like the McGonagall showing up in the Crimes of Grindelwald. It's like, hey, but no, you can't mess up.
How does that happen?
I don't know. Well, the thing is, okay, so I will say that most of like big franchises like this, Star Wars and Harry Potter and stuff, they do have people on staff whose sole job it is to keep the canon straight.
Right.
Is to just make sure, like, oh, you're putting this in a novel? Does it conflict with anything we've said in other novels? It's my job to have read all of the things and know all of the things and double check against all the things.
To know whether or not there's a conflicting fact.
Can you, like, that is a way I think the novels would affect the movies. It's like, oh, did you want this character to do that? Well,
Right, like you can't. Okay, so here's my question for you then. As, I don't even know that we can call ourselves experts necessarily, but like well-read in the world. Is that a job that you would be willing to accept doing as a way to be more involved with the actual creation of a Harry Potter story if it meant that you were no longer able to speculate on it? Like, would you trade our ability to speculate for your ability to create?
It's interesting to know whether or not you, like, what your level of creation would be like. The name for these people at Harry Potter is called Potterologists, by the way.
Okay, so if you could be considered a co-writer of a Fantastic Beasts big screen film,
yeah,
like writing credits on the movie,
yeah,
would you trade what we do for that label?
Oh yeah, probably.
You would?
I mean, to get to help make the thing? That'd be so cool.
I mean, it would be so cool, but like, yeah. I mean, a certain amount of our livelihood does come from our speculation.
If you're like a writer on a giant Harry Potter Warner Brothers movie, I think your livelihood's pretty taken care of.
Is it? I mean, I have no idea.
I don't know.
I don't know how these things work.
I bet they're doing pretty good financially.
Interesting. I see. I feel I have absolutely. I'm speaking from nothing more than my own mental argument. I have no idea what that would be.
Mm.
What that number would be like. What if it would be worth it? Like, how weird would it be if our actual job was just more worth it than being involved with actually creating it?
Boy, that'd be a predicament. That would be a predicament.
Because but I feel like it would be so cool to be on the inside.
I think we're good at our job because we are big fans of the things, and it would be such an honor to be a part of creating one of the things. That would be also part of being a fan, you know?
Okay, next question for you. Do you think we could do it?
Do you think we could do it?
You and I, do you think that we are capable? I mean, we've never written a screenplay before, ever.
Yeah.
We're not writers by trade or training or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Would we be capable of writing a story?
I mean, I'm sure we could come up with a story. I don't know if we could, like, format it appropriately for Hollywood or something, but
there are people that do that,
I'm sure. There are people who do that, can adapt your script to screenplay or whatever, right? That's a thing. That's a job someone has.
So, okay, so hypothetically, if all we had to do was come up with a story, go into a room, and basically, like, whiteboard the entire thing out, could we do it?
I'm sure we could.
Yeah?
I think so.
Who do we call?
I don't know.
I want to know who to call.
We don't. Here's the thing. We don't have to add to someone else's story. We can just write our own story. You know what I mean?
Well, I get that.
Yeah.
Then we have to make up all of our own characters and their motives and intentions. And
yeah.
You're going to
have to do that anyway.
I know, but it's different when it gives me the palm sweats.
Gives you the palm sweats. That's how you know you're doing good. That's how you know you're onto something.
Right, right.
You gotta have the courage to do that.
Yeah, okay. All right. Well, anyway, I feel like we've covered an enormous number of things today. I very much enjoyed talking about all of the peripheral worlds of everything.
Yeah.
I'll be curious to know how everybody feels about the Gamora paradox.
Oh, yes.
Does a intended scene that was left out still count? That ends up being probably the question of the day for us today. If you guys have any thoughts on that or the episode at all, be sure to use hashtag popcorn culture. You can follow us on Twitter. I think, hopefully, maybe, you might have to look it up a couple of times. I'm pretty sure our handle is at a popcast.
Yes, that is what it is. A popcast.
Look at us go.
Yeah.
Look at us go.
Check us out on Twitter at a popcast.
Absolutely.
That's the official popcorn culture podcast account.
Nice. Look at you using words.
Yeah. I thought of them.
I thought of them all on my own.
I even said them out loud.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Anyway, guys, until next time. Bye.
Bye-bye.